Shiv Jehazashin Brand graduated from Rutgers University in 1994 with a Bachelor of Arts degree in psychology and a minor in Middle Eastern studies. He then went to Syria to pursue studies in Islamic juristic methodology, theology, and logic with renowned scholars, and then continued these studies in Morocco. And he's now currently working as a research associate. The title of his talk today is quite interesting. It's Ethical Purpose in Sacred Law, Priorities for Tomorrow and the Next Day. And in order to try and summarize what this talk will be about, it's about the responsibilities that Muslims have to contribute positively to the world around them by means of adhering to and following our own traditions and sacred laws. So without further ado, I'll hand over to Sheikh.
Everybody is well tonight, inshallah. In the name of Allah, all praise to Allah and blessings on the Messenger of Allah. Ethical purpose in sacred law, priorities for tomorrow and the next day. We live in disquieting times. As we see more and more the predictions of the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam reflected in the world that we live in. We live in times where selfishness to the exclusion of the public good has become preeminent. The Prophet said, إِذَا رَأَيْتَ شُحًّا مُطَاعًا وَهَوًا مُتَّبَعًا وَدُنْيَا مُؤَثَّرًا وَإِعْجَابَ كُلِّ ذِي رَأْيٍ بِرَأْيِهِ فَعَلَيْكَ بِخَاسَةِ نَفْسِكَ وَدَعَ الْعَوَامَةَ أو أمر العامة فإن من ورائكم أيام الصبر. When you see greed obeyed and every passion pursued and the material world of primary influence, every opinionated person self-impressed by his own opinion, and that at that point you are advised to keep to yourself and leave the public affairs, because before you are days that will require great patience. We live in times where faith itself is in the balance. The Prophet said, عليه السلام, وَيْلٌ لِلْعَرَبِ مِنْ شَرٍ قَدْ اقْتَرَبٍ. Woe to the Arabs for a fitna, a troubling discord that has drawn near, like a portion of dark night. A man will awake a believer and go to bed a disbeliever. He sells his religion for some cheap trinket of the world. We live in times where seclusion from the din of the public space may be the only way for some to retain safety and sanctity of the virtuous life. يُشِكُ أَن يَكُونَ خَيْرَ مَالِ الْمُسْلِمِ غَنَمٌ يَتَّبِعُ بِهَا شَعَثَ الْجِبَالِ. In the Sahih of Bukhari, the time is drawing near that the best property of a Muslim will be a flock of sheep that he tends on the mountain sides and the places of rainfall. He flees with his religion from the chaos. We live in a time where shallow and facile opinion passes as scholarship. إِنَّ اللَّهَ لَا يَقْبِدُ الْعِلْمَ إِنْتِزَاعًا يَنْتَزِعُهُ مِنْ صُدُورِ النَّاسِ. In the Musannaf of Ibn Abi Shayba, verily Allah does not take away knowledge by stripping it from the breasts of men, but he takes away knowledge by taking away the scholars until there remains not one scholar. The people take on ignorant leaders. They are asked and they give opinion without knowledge. They are misguided and they misguide others. We live in times that to retain an attachment to religion itself and to stand by one's principles is as to attempt to hold on to a red-hot coal. يَتِّي عَلَى النَّاسِ زَمَانٌ أَصَّابِرُ فِيهِمْ عَلَى دِينِهِ كَالْقَابِدِ عَلَى الْجَمْرَةِ. A time will overtake the people when the person who patiently maintains his religion is like someone holding on to a hot coal. For those who would be courageous enough during these very times to hold to the good, to adhere to the straight and narrow, and to there will be for them a tremendous station. لِلْعَامِلِ مِنْهُمْ أَجْرُ خَمْسِينَ. The Prophet ﷺ said, for those in those days who will be courageous enough to do good, to stick to the good, right? To do good deeds. Whoever makes an effort among them will have, he said to his companions, the reward of 50 of you. And they said, you mean 50 of them, right? Were the companions of Rasulullah? He said, no, 50 of you. Because لِأَنَّكُمْ تَجِدُونَ عَلَى الْخَيْرِ أَعْوَانَ وَهُمْ لَا يَجِدُونَ عَلَى الْخَيْرِ أَعْوَانَ. Because you all find help to do the good, but they will find no help. Brothers and sisters, these are the times that we live in. In this time, the most important thing that the Muslim community can do is to stand by its principles. A story is often told by the scholars in the books of the Etiquettes and Virtues of Knowledge. It illustrates the centrality and importance of learning and the learned class to our whole tradition. In it, or as the story goes, a scholar was observing a boy walking in the street from a window above. The boy missed his step and almost slipped and fell, and the scholar, in his concern, called out to the boy, "Be careful, don't slip and fall." And the boy turned back to the scholar and said, "No, you be careful. Because if I fall, it was just a boy who fell. But if you fall, a whole nation falls." This is the place of the scholar in the Muslim community. But what of the place, we can extrapolate from this, the place of the Muslim community in the world community? The Muslims, the meaning of the word Islam, obviously, we've all been through this over and over again since September 11th. It means peace, right? Or it means submission. Which is it, peace or submission? When a person submits to the natural order of things upon which the world has been created or the universe has been created, when he relinquishes resistance to the natural order of things in the very fitrah, the very original human nature upon which he was born, peace takes place in his environment with all of those around him. The meaning of insan, human being, comes from the root anasa, from uns, which means the solace and comfort that happens or that takes place when you're in the companion of someone, right, that you trust and find comfort in. And the insan, when his humanity is completed, everything around him finds uns with him, finds this solace and this comfort with him. So it is the mission and responsibility of the Muslims to retain that original human state, to stand up for what is good in the world, okay, and not just to pursue their own basic rights, right, that may be in some places and times in the world trampled, and so on and so forth, but they can't allow the difficulties that they may face in some parts of the world to cause them to relinquish their original mission, and that is to uphold what is good in the world, right? To be sensitive to the needs of the other. لَا يَجْرِمَنَّكُمْ شَنَآنُ قَوْمٍ, right? عَلَىٰ أَن لَا تَعْدِلُوا. Don't let your dislike, your frustration, your hatred for a people cause you to leave off the way of fairness, right? Be fair, be just. That is closer to God consciousness. So just as the position of the scholar amongst Muslims, right, is such that he carries the meanings of the way itself, so too the Muslims amongst nations are responsible to carry these values and virtues. But these people who would stand up to carry these values and keep them alive, they will need courage. They will have to draw from the Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa sallam that courage that he showed, right, when he stood in Mecca before his uncle Abi Talib, and the leaders of the Quraysh were offering him their wealth, right, to their most beautiful women. They were offering him to be their king, even if he would just relinquish criticizing their lifestyle and those things that they were attached to. And what did he say in response? He said, "By Allah, if you put the sun in my right hand and the moon in my left hand, I will not give up this mission, even if it be the life of me." Now, so who are these people? Right? These are people who are in touch with that original human nature, that fitra that we've talked about. How many people here are familiar with the concept of fitra in Islam? Right? I would imagine a lot. Right? We don't put hands up in the UK. Right? How many people are familiar with the fitra? Right? Kullu mawludin, every newborn child is born according to the fitra. There are people in this world who have maintained or been able to maintain, or by some divine success, have been able to maintain something of that innocence, something of that goodness. Some of them are Muslims. Some of them are not Muslims. Those who are not Muslims, who have been able to retain some traces of that original human goodness, innocence, are referred to in the Quran as the Ulul Baqiyya, the people of the remnants. There are Muslims whose fitra has practically been erased, okay, has been lost. Who are the people that are addressed by the discourse of the way of Islam? They are these people of fitra. They are these Ulul Baqiyya, these people of the remnants. They are the strangers who were referred to by the Prophet Muhammad as the Ghuraba. That this way began in the world as a stranger, and at the end of time, it will return as a stranger, ghariban. So felicity and joy is for the strangers. Who are the strangers? The strangers are people who are not distracted, diverted by secondary affiliations from their focus, which is to maintain these teachings and to maintain this good. And if we look carefully at our tradition, we find that the khitab, the discourse of Islam, embraces anyone who has a qalb wa alqa sama wa huwa shaheed. Anyone who has a heart and is conscious. Okay, we have many addresses in the Quran, in the hadith, that have what we call an usul al-fiqh, or sacred law theory, sighat al-umum, the formula of the general reference, right? A general scope of application. Wherever we have an address, such as when Allah says, Ya ayyuhan nas, O mankind, He's not speaking to Muslims alone. But when He speaks to you about your treatment of the neighbor, there is nothing to limit that understanding that we're only supposed to be good to our Muslim neighbor. When He talks about how a human being should be treated by another human being, or how a brother should be treated by his brother, there's no reason not to understand that as brotherhood and humanity. Imam Nawawi, right, who is not just the famous hadith scholar, right, traditionalist, right? He was also one of the greatest scholars of jurisprudence and law. He said in his commentary on the hadith that none of you truly believes until he wants for his brother what he wants for himself, that this includes your brother in humanity. But even more recent than that, the great Egyptian scholar of the 1950s, Muhammad Abu Zahra, I was reading recently on my way to Istanbul his book in international law, and he mentioned that there is nothing to limit the scope of the word brother in the narration that Allah does not cease to be in the assistance of His slave so long as His slave does not cease to be in the assistance of his brother. There is nothing to limit that the use of that term to the Muslim only. Right? That can also include one's brother in humanity. What I'm trying to say is that we have to look again at our texts and realize that when a prophet comes to a people, when he enters into among a people, his discourse is not to the choir. His discourse is not to the limited group who have signed on, because he has no group yet. Right? He is speaking with his revelation. He is speaking with his conversation. He is in conversation with the non-believing public. So that discourse can encompass all. And when we see who are these people who will stand up for the good and carry these principles, well, they are anyone who has a conscience, right? They are anyone who has a conscience and have a feeling for the goodness of humanity and are listening and paying attention. And we'll find that some of them, right, some Muslims will not pay attention to this, right? And some non-Muslims will, okay? Muslims have been given the responsibility to ensure that justice and fairness prevail in the world and society. Ya ayyuhalladhina amanu kunu qawwamina bilqisti shuhada'a lillahi walau ala anfusikum. O you who believe, stand up for justice and fairness as witnesses to Allah, even if over your very selves. Allah has made Muslims as witnesses to Him over mankind, and not witnesses in the sort of election or a chosen people, but to ensure balance in the world. وَكَذَلَكَ جَعَلْنَاكُمْ أُمَّةً وَسَطًا لِتَكُونُوا شُهَدَاءَ عَلَى النَّاسِ. And as such, we have made you a nation of the middle path, that you might be witnesses over the people. The Prophet has told us, Muhammad alayhi salam, has told us that there will not cease to be a group from among his people that will stand up for truth, right? And they will not be harmed by those who forsake them until the end of time comes, until the command of Allah comes, وَهُمْ عَلَى ذَلِكَ, and they are as such. In the Islamic view with regard to the human relationship to the Divine, Islam, or the Islamic view, makes two assumptions. First, there is the assumption of responsibility, that we call taklif. And then there is the assumption of accountability, hisab. The first assumption of taklif is the responsibility to pursue a certain course of action in life. Okay, taklif. To assume, yani the responsibility to comport oneself, to pursue certain responsibilities and actions in life. The second, the assumption of accountability, is the accountability to recognize that one exists in the world for a purpose. One is accountable, right, to exist for a purpose in the world. The believer is then bound by these two assumptions to a set of higher order purposes in the life of this world. And these higher order purposes are found in two constellations, like the constellations of stars. Each star in the constellation is a point that guides, just like Allah says in the Quran, وَبِالنَّجْمِ هُمْ يَهْتَدُونَ, and by the stars they are guided. The first constellation of principles. Each principle is a star that guides us in the night of our existence, emanating from the assumption of responsibility. So this constellation comes up from that assumption of responsibility, are the five aims and purposes of sacred law, the five maqasid of Sharia. How many people here are familiar with the five maqasid of Sharia? Right? Can I get a show of hands? Right? Can I get an amen? Right? How many people are familiar with the five maqasid of Sharia? Right? These are the aims and purposes of Islamic law. The reason that Islamic law exists. Islamic law, sacred law, Sharia law. They exist to ensure and secure for society the preservation of freedom of conscience. Right? That we call the preservation of deen or religion. But the preservation of deen and religion and the Islamic concept that there is no coercion in religion means to preserve for every member of society the freedom to choose his own way. He will be accountable for that choice to his Creator, right? But there is no coercion in religion. So in a sense, the first point of the five aims and purposes of sacred law, right? The first star in our constellation is the security to secure freedom of conscience. And the second is what, for those who know? Right? The preservation or protection of life itself. The reason why the sacred law exists. And then, the preservation of the intellect. And then, the preservation of human dignity. And fifth, the preservation of property. If we look, if we go back from these 5 points to the first, which was the preservation of religion or freedom of conscience, we see that from this one opens up a whole new vista on another constellation of principles. And this second constellation and higher constellation are the maqasid, or the aims and purposes of the religion of Islam itself. And they are three. They are three. The first is devotion, ubudiyya. The second is imara, or positive development of the world around us. And the third is purification, or tazkiyah. The first, ubudiyya, devotion, signifies the relationship of the slave, or the human soul, right, to its creator. It's the vertical relationship. The second, that of imara, which we translate as development, but that is positive, organic, sustainable development, is the responsibility of the slave to augment the good in the world, to be a source of good in the world. It denotes his relationship with his environment around him, which includes the human environment, the built environment, the animal environment or animate environment, and the natural environment. It is the horizontal relationship. Allah says in the Quran, Huwa ansha'akum min al-ardi wasta'marakum fiha. He is the one that produced you from the earth and caused you to be responsible for its development, imarataha. The third, purification. What does that signify? If the first was the vertical relationship of the human soul with its creator, and the second was the horizontal relationship, what then would be the purification? Would be the relationship of the human soul with itself, right? One of his objectives in life, right, is to purify his heart. Purifying his heart begins with maintaining that fitra, that original human nature. Now, as we've enumerated these three aims and purposes of the religion of Islam itself, devotion, development, and purification, this is the enumeration of the current Mufti of Egypt, Dr. Ali Jumaa, who was a great scholar, who we followed his thought very closely before he was ever elected to the position of Mufti. So his political affiliation, right, should not reflect on the strength of his scholarship, and I'm sure many people here in the room know him and have read many of his works. He enumerates them as these three, and he quotes Shatibi on that. However, if we look to the Dhari'a ila Makarim al-Sharia of Ar-Raghib al-Asfahani, we find that he enumerates them a bit differently, right? He says, Ar-Raghib al-Asfahani was a great scholar. Everyone knows his, many people know his Mufradat al-Qur'an, right? He has a tafsir that explains only the main terms used throughout the Qur'an. He wrote another book that is not as well known, called The Expedience to the Noble Characteristics of Sacred Law. And if you look at Haji Khalifa, when he speaks about this book, he mentions an interesting fact that it is said or reported that Imam Abu Hamid al-Ghazali, the author of The Revival of the Religious Sciences, Ihya al-Lumuddin, he never traveled except that he carried with him this book of Ar-Raghib al-Asfahani. What does that tell us? That tells us that Ar-Raghib al-Asfahani is one of the influences on the great theological work, The Revival of the Religious Sciences. And in this book, he enumerates the three aims and purposes of religion, but he says that instead of purification, they are devotion, development, and stewardship, khilafah, the caliphate. But there's really no contradiction between the two sets of enumerations. I was recently sitting in a meeting in which we had Sheikh Abdallah bin Bayya, Dr. Ali Jumaa himself, and Dr. Saeed Ramadan Al-Bouti, among others. And we were speaking about this issue, and there was a consensus amongst everyone in the room that khalas, right? These three points, they are the content of stewardship itself. So devotion, development, and purification, they are the content of stewardship. The responsibility that man has been given in the earth by God. And when we say that man has been given this, man here obviously includes woman, right? So who said the sisters can't be caliph, right? But man, not Muslim, not Muslima, every responsible adult human being is caliph of Allah in the earth. And through this we see that as we ascended into the higher order principles, from one phase of the five aims and purposes of sacred law to the three aims and purposes of religion itself, through them being the contents of the caliphate or stewardship, we come back down and we see that the responsibility that every human being, going back to our beginning and expanding the remit of the Islamic discourse to include everyone who has a heart and a conscience, right, is to employ these five objectives of sacred law in every action that they might engage in the world. And now I have to see where I ended up in my notes. Tayyib. Here is, we have this responsibility. I would have liked to have spoken more about imara, but we can, yani development, but we can save that for another time. Tayyib. I did have something that was interesting. An example of the applications of this model of the two levels of constellations, and the responsibility of stewardship to pursue, right, these purposes in the world with regard to the environment. We have first, that first aim and purpose of religion itself was devotion, ubudiyyah. That, regarding the environment, is manifested through shukr, or gratefulness, for what we have received in the natural world from God. We gain from the natural world our sustenance. We subject, we harness nature, right? To use a post-enlightenment term. We harness nature, we employ nature for our own advancement and betterment. And now I'm falling into the myth of progress. But we benefit tremendously from nature. We receive so much from this natural environment. Well, the responsibility of ubudiyyah, of devotion, tells us that our relationship with the natural environment from this aim and purpose is one of gratefulness and thanksgiving to God, which is a very important way station on the spiritual path. What is the technical definition of shukr, of thanksgiving, of giving thanks? It is صرف العبد جميع ما أنعم الله به عليه نعم إلى ما خلق من أجله. It is the slave's disposing with or employing everything that God has given him in the way for which it was, in the purpose for which it was created, to use things the way they are meant to be used, right? I mean, we all know the lecture that our parents give us. Right? Look, if you don't use it the way it was meant to be used, it's going to break. You know, and the same thing with the natural world. And that is the meaning of shukr. Okay? To use things in the way they are meant to be used. Now let's look at the aim and purpose of purification of the human soul with regard to the environment. That is manifested through the activity of dhikr, remembrance. We look at the natural world and we're reminded of its creator. When we see in it beauty, we're reminded of Allah as Jamal. When we derive from it our nourishment, we're reminded that Allah is Ar-Razzaq. When we see an apple on a tree or a fruit on a tree, we're reminded, right, of the beauty and sustenance of God. We're reminded of God. Okay? As we see the seasons coming and going, Right? We see Allah as the one who raises things up, the one who gives life and the one who gives death. Right? In winter, He gives death to the earth, and in the springtime, it's ihtazzat wa rabat. It reverberates, it vibrates, and springs forth and blossoms with life. So when we gaze upon creation, we're reminded of Allah, and we begin to respect creation because it is a place in which that reflects, it is a mirror of the 99 names of God. Now, we move on in this model to the understanding in the Quran that the entire earth has been subjugated to the service of man. We know this, okay? But this is only, right? What this means is that man is responsible to direct through stewardship environmental resources toward these five maqasid, these five aims and purposes of sacred law, toward the preservation of freedom of conscience, toward the preservation of life, toward the preservation of intellect, and all of those ways, the preservation of human dignity, right? Well, to allow people to go hungry in the world or to go unclothed is definitely not moving natural resources in a direction that will feed people in the world, clothe people in the world, and provide everybody with a quality of life that shores up their basic human dignity, which is a maqsid of Islam. Now, this is what it means to be a steward to the environment. But as we look at the situation of the environment today, we become increasingly aware, right, or painfully aware is a better way to say it, of the potential for abuse of the environment. Potential abuses of this development maqsid of the earth, of the subjugation of the land, are controlled through the forms of dhikr and shukr. When those two are absent from the equation, the regulating controls are gone and abuse of the environment obtains. So when we're not employing those two aims of and purposes of dhikr and shukr, or remembrance of God, witnessing the reflection of God in the environment, and appreciation and thanksgiving and gratefulness, that is when abuse happens in the environment, right? Because the stewardship becomes faulty. Now, Sheikh Abdallah bin Bayya, is one of the foremost Arabic-speaking scholars of our age. He's also fluent in French, former Chief Justice of Mauritania. Now he is a professor at and also a Minister of Education and of Mauritania. He is now a member of the Fiqh Council in Jeddah and a professor at the university there. He has mentioned three crises that face this community, the community of Muslims today. And if we have three crises facing the community of the Muslims today, then what they are is they are crises in the ability of that community to engage in that stewardship of which they have been, or that mission of which they have been responsible. And those three crises that he has identified is first what he calls inkimashun fil qudratil falsafiyya, a shrinking of philosophical ability in the Muslim community, right? I think that all of us can witness that. The second is an inability to deploy the principles of sacred law theory, or the principles of the Islamic worldview. Because when I speak of sacred law, when I speak of Sharia, I see the Sharia as being something broader than jurisprudence proper. I see the Sharia as being the worldview of Islam, if we look, because it encompasses all of the sciences, right, of Islamic knowledge, right, of course, other than the arts, right, and other than the physical sciences, but all of these sciences that we might study, historiography, right, textual criticism, All of that is found in the Sharia sciences. And if we look deeply at the root of the word Sharia, we see that its original meaning in Arabic is that it is a pathway that leads to a watering place. Right? It's a pathway that leads to water. Okay? That's the meaning of Sharia. Tayyib. So the Sharia contains within it dynamic methodologies, techniques, and tools that allow us to mine the possibilities of our tradition. If we are unable, if we are not even aware of what they are, then how will we ever get into a position where not only we know what they are, but we're in a position to use them? Because it's one thing to be a swordsmith, and it's another thing for the swordsmith to be left behind when everybody goes off to battle, right? Because he himself doesn't know how to use the sword when it comes down to it. And I'm sure that we could think of some other politically correct parable than the sword. The second was the inability to deploy the methodological tools of sacred law or sacred knowledge. And the third is a crisis in our relationship with the other. Okay? And our crisis in our relationship with other communities. Going to the first now. The crisis of the shrinking of philosophical ability. What I see is that we can take these crises and we can flip them into first seeing them as challenges, and through that, seeing them as formulating priorities for the days to come, the days that face the Muslim community in a more sort of positive endeavor or focus. The first was the crisis of the shrinking of philosophical ability within, and that would be within the maqsid or aim and purpose of preservation of the intellect. This would be in the ability to discern and analyze the content of situations and then lay out or formulate a prescription for treatment or a path ahead. This is a challenge to the maqsid of the preservation of intellect, as we've mentioned, and it becomes the critical analytic priority or the academic priority, if you will. We are in a position where we need to train our generations in this community to have this critical ability, to look deeply into the situations that face them, to analyze them, to break them down. Tahleel, right, is the word for analysis in Arabic, and it means to break something down into its component parts, right? Look at that and come up with a treatment. This is grounded, this responsibility to have this critical philosophical or intellectual ability in our ummah, it's grounded in the fact that we follow a prophet. One of the four conditions of his prophecy is fatana, right? Is discerning intelligence, which is the ability to receive any argument from an opponent and break it down and turn it on its head. That's one of the conditions of prophecy, fatana. And we claim, right, to be following that prophet, Muhammad, right, who said about the Muslims that the believer is kayyisun fatin, is discerning and perspicacious, and has this intellectual ability, right? And there's no end to the praise of knowledge and the sciences in Islam. If we move on to the second, which was the crisis in the ability to employ or deploy the principles of sacred law theory or the dynamic methodological principles of sacred knowledge. This is a challenge to the maqsid of stewardship itself. We have no methodology for stewardship. We're not even clear on what our organic, inherent, natural methodologies are. And what are we doing here in the West? We're looking at Western philosophy. We're learning their models, such as Wittgensteinian language games and things like this, okay? And we are then reading Islam through these filters. That's fine, right? And I think that we should continue this process. We should analyze these things, look at that. Al-hikmatu dhalat al-mu'min, right? Wisdom is the lost artifact of the believer, but we have to be clear going into it what are our own organic and inherently Islamic models that we start with and use to filter our understanding of the world, and in fact serve as criteria for the analysis of any situation or case that we may face or propose to treat. Right? Why is this a challenge to stewardship in its entirety? Right? One, this was because these sciences or these methodological techniques and tools and principles, right? They are the criterion for analysis. They are the map that guides us, and they are the methodology of istinbat, iqtibas, and ijtihad. Okay? All of them are very similar. Let's start with iqtibas. Iqtibas is a process or methodology that is engaged in, right? Which means to derive from, or to pull from, or to borrow from, actually, to borrow from the primary texts of the Quran and the ahadith, the reports of the Prophet Muhammad alayhi salam, to borrow from them meanings that we might employ in different circumstances, right? Or apply to a new situation, such as in the Quran, we find the statement of Allah, لَوْلَا دَفْعُ اللَّهِ بَعْضَ النَّاسَ بَعْضَهُمْ بِبَعْضٍ لَفَسَدَتِ الْأَرْضِ. If it were not for the fact that Allah pushes one group of people against another group of people, the earth would have been corrupted. We borrow that from the Quran. And we see in that, we abstract that into its higher universals, and we see that if it were not for the fact that there is a playing off of one another in the world, between peoples, between ideas, the earth would have become stagnant and there would be no creativity. That is iqtibas. And what is iqtibas? Is borrowing. It comes from qabasa. What did Moses say when he went to the edge of the valley and he saw the fire in the valley? And he said to his family, wait here. I will go to this fire and I'm sure there'll be people around that fire, and I'll ask them from news. And at the very least, I'll come back to you, right, with a portion of fire ourselves, that we may keep ourselves warm and light our way in the dark. Isn't that what the fire did for them? But he said, I will return bi qabasin min nur. Qabas. And that's what the process of iqtibas, this borrowing, is all about. The second one was istinbat. Istinbat is at the heart of ijtihad. Everyone here is familiar with ijtihad, right? I imagine that no one here is doing anything at Cambridge University and King's College except trying to pry open the doors of ijtihad, right? My question is, who said ijtihad ever had doors, right? I mean, where did that come from, you know? There are conditions and qualifications, right? And whoever has them can march right through the door, right? But at the heart of ijtihad is istinbat. How many people are familiar with the term istinbat? This is an exciting one. Right? It's been boring this whole time, right? I realize that, but now we're going to see something real latif, real nice, right? Istinbat, it comes from nabata. Nabata. Nabata al-ma, when the water, right, waters up or wells up from the earth. That's nabata al-ma. And istinbat, with a seen in the ta of talab or seeking, is when one pulls water out of the earth. When one creates a well and digs the well and the first water comes out, right? And they start pulling that water out of the earth, that's istinbat. And what is that water? That the Sharia is the road that leads to, right? That's the source of life itself, right? Allah says in the Quran, right, that He created every living thing from water. Okay, so what are we pulling out of the Quran and the Sunnah and our sacred texts and our tradition and all of this inheritance, this Torah, this heritage, right? We're pulling out life-giving water that nourishes us, We have the qabasa, we have the fire, that the light that keeps us warm and guides our way in the dark, the water that nourishes us. This is all ijtihad. This is what ijtihad is about. And there are tools and techniques to do this that we should be familiar with. The last thing about ijtihad, what does ijtihad mean? Well, it goes back to the steward, right? The one made responsible to maintain these higher order purposes in the world. Ijtihad comes from jahada, to expend effort. And ijtihada means to exhaust oneself. Because it is the responsibility of the mujtahid scholar to spare no effort and to literally exhaust himself in trying, or herself, excuse me, right, in trying to pull out the answer and the guidance and the best way forward for the community. And what community? Right? Well, the community of Muhammad is divided into two halves, right? The ummat of da'wah and the ummat al-istijaba, right? The community, the ummah that has answered his call and the ummah that has yet to receive his call, but they are all the community of Muhammad. It's inclusive, and we have to start thinking of the discourse of our deen as being inclusive. That, so this challenge, right, to the stewardship, right, illustrating its importance, becomes the methodological priority for us in the days that we come. And it represents the ability to define or extrapolate a way forward, right? And I think that we've spoken more than enough, and we don't need to go any deeper into this. But what about the crisis in our relationship with the other, the third of these crises that Shaykh Abdallah bin Bayya has enumerated? It is a challenge to the maqsid of deen, the aim and purpose of religion and development itself. How does it become the challenge to religion itself? It becomes the challenge to religion itself because it is, or the preservation of religion, because the responsibility of the steward in the earth or in the society is to ensure that everyone has free access to look at the religion of Islam and any other religion on offer and think for themselves, right, and decide for themselves. So if we have a crisis in our relationship with the other, in that they don't understand what Islam is, they don't understand the content of Islam, or they don't have access to understand what Islam properly is, well, then there is a crisis here in this one aim and purpose. They don't have access. It is the responsibility to ensure access. We're not out to make people Muslim, but what we are out to do is to let people have the freedom to choose, to understand, have access to the understanding, and make a decision for themselves, right? This is the difference between the way of Muslims and the way of proselytizing. But it is also a challenge to development, positive development. And how is that? Right? Well, it's the responsibility of the steward to augment the good in the world, to be providing enhancements to the quality of life, right, of everyone around us, to be protecting the environment, believe it or not. It's all in there if we are drawing it out. Okay? It's that responsibility is there, but if we have a crisis in our relationship with the people who we share this world with, how will they ever trust us to perform this duty? Right? Where will the trust be? So this, in turn, we want to flip it into a priority that we might call the communication priority, right, or the discourse priority. As shifting on, all of these higher order purposes and all of these nuances within the sacred law, and the title of the session was meant to be ethical purpose in sacred law, and I wanted to talk about ethics and morality and how at the heart of every rule of law there is a rationale, what we call the illah. The illah, or the ratio legis, at the heart of this rule is there to secure and ensure the wisdom behind the rule itself, the purpose of the rule itself. And that purpose or wisdom behind the reason why the rule is there, that is secured by the regulating principle of the illa, are those higher order purposes, right? And they are ethical, right? When, yani, they are either ethical or moral. An ethical purpose, right, witnesses justice, right? It's there to secure justice and fairness in society. A moral principle or purpose witnesses virtue, witnesses that is being done as a spiritual action. But if people are not doing or performing or following or employing the rules because of a spiritual calling, intending, right, the countenance of God, well, then at least they're doing it for ethical reasons, which secure the public good. So that's enough of that. But none of this works without ihsan, right? Without spiritual excellence, or the spirituality at the heart of it that takes us to a level where we are witnessing God. We are witnessing the bigger picture. It is only ihsan that can make all this work. None of it works unless you are seeing Allah, unless you are witnessing Allah. Ihsan is that you live the life of devotion to Allah as though you are seeing Him and beholding His presence. Ihsan is the kernel. And is there anybody here who doesn't know what ihsan is? Right? It's okay. Right? We'll work through it together. But I think everybody here knows what ihsan is, that spiritual excellence. It has been defined by the Prophet alayhi salam as that you worship Allah. We all know this hadith, that you worship Allah as though you are seeing Him. Khalas. Right? That you worship Allah as though you are seeing Him. The though here comes from the fact that you don't see Him with the eyes of your sight, but you see Him with the basira. Not the basar, but the basira, the eyes of your heart, witness the presence of God. That's ihsan. If you can't make it to that, well then at least you have knowledge that He sees you. Right? And emanating from all of this is how that influences your relationship with the people around you. Right? And that's the spiritual excellence. And that's how ihsan also connotes, right, the epitome of goodness, the quintessence of goodness. Tayyib. And this ihsan that makes all this whole scheme or schemata work is the kernel that nourishes two fruits in the heart of the soul of the believer. The first is the fruit of consciousness, and the second is conscientiousness. The consciousness is to be awake to the presence of God. I think I even wrote something about it here. Consciousness is that you be awake to the divine presence, that your heart have presence with Allah in conscious awareness and wakefulness, that you be attentive to the divine presence, right? Just like an empty room that's full of chairs, right? In some type of experimental program, right? They bring you into the room and they sit you down in this room full of chairs with no windows. They go to the door and they turn the lights out. Okay? They turn the lights out and they leave you there. You can't see anything. You can't see the hand in front of your face, but you can hear your heart pounding. It's silent. And then the door opens and a little bit of light comes in and you can see that they brought someone else into the room. Right? And the door closes. The lights are dark. The room is black. Can you feel the presence of that other person in the room? Right? Can you feel that someone else is in the room with you? That is that maqam of ihsan. That you feel experientially the presence of God. And if you feel experientially the presence of God, right? And that uns, that solace, that comfort that comes with it. Could you ever be lonely? Right? And that is the consciousness, that feeling of the presence of God. And the second, the conscientiousness that emanates from that wakefulness, that wakeful state. Conscientiousness is when that state of presence of heart turns to a sensitivity to the needs and well-being of others, and you deal with people in a way that is caring for their rights and sensitive to their needs. And this in turn expands from beyond being sensitive to people to also being sensitive to all life forms as well, and the environment itself. Everything becomes the recipient of your ihsan. وَعِبَادُ الرَّحْمَانِ الَّذِينَ يَمْشُونَ عَلَى الْأَرْضِ هَوْنَا. The slaves of the All-Merciful who tread gently upon the earth. These slaves of the All-Merciful, okay? These slaves of the All-Merciful, notice that Allah used in this verse His name, the All-Merciful. He could have said, وَعِبَادُ Allah. And He does that in the Quran. The slaves of Allah are the ones who tread gently. But He called them the slaves of the Ar-Rahman. From their qualities is that they are gentle with the earth. They don't leave behind a significant carbon footprint. Right? Now, what else? What about this Ar-Rahman that is the chosen quality, right, to whom, right, these slaves claim service? Well, He is the one who also said, وَرَحْمَتِي وَسِعَتْ كُلَّ شَيْءٍ. And My mercy, My compassion has enveloped everything. And we follow in the service of that All-Merciful One, so shouldn't our compassion also envelop everything? And the first narration that is ever taught to a student of knowledge by a teacher, right, al-hadith al-musalsal bil-awwaliyya, the hadith that is narrated as the first narration is, نعم, الرحمون يرحمهم الرحمن تبارك وتعالى. Those who show compassion will be shown to them by the All-Compassionate. إِرْحَمُوا مَنْ فِي الْأَرْضِ يَرْحَمْكُمْ مَنْ فِي السَّمَاءِ. Show compassion to those in the earth, and those in the heavens will show compassion to you. طيب, to wind this down, we see these challenges ahead of this community, and we have formulated them in terms of priorities for the days to come. Priorities that we will employ in the treatment of them, these higher order principles that we have talked about. The five aims and purposes of sacred law: preservation of religion, preservation of life, preservation of intellect, preservation of human dignity, and preservation of property. And the five aims and purposes of religion itself: devotion, development, and purification. To treat these priorities, right? This is what is in front of us. I have a few suggestions for action for the Muslim community, right? I'll be giving this speech to bigger communities in Manchester and a few other, Birmingham also. So I have some suggestions for them. But I don't know how well they will, how much they're needed by academics such as yourselves. But the first, scholars in the West who are responsible for these methodological tools and techniques, they need to have a self-governing body, right, that negotiates positions on critical issues of culture and modernity, right, as well as policies regarding the issuance of fatwa, legal opinion, in a Western European or North American context, right? We also need, as a community, to methodically and thoughtfully develop a discourse that is in communication with the other, right, with not the non-Muslim world, and not ourselves only, right? We have to realize that we share the society with other with other people. They are our neighbors. They are, for many of us, our family members, right? And when we speak, we need to be speaking to them. We need to be speaking to everyone else, and not just having conversations within ourselves. Another, we need to be consciously aware of the paradigms and ideas that we employ in our language, or that are in play in the context of our intellectual conversations and investigations. When we apply a model, We have to know where that model came from. When we use a word, we have to know if it is paradigm loaded. What is the genealogy of that word and that idea? Where did it come from? And why are we using it? Okay? We mentioned before progress. Where does this advancement? Where do these ideas come from? Right? They have a source in our recent modern history, and I'm not saying don't use them, but just know where they come from and know where they fit in the whole scheme of things. Where does the paradigm of the social sciences fit vis-a-vis that of the humanities? We need to recognize a distribution of responsibilities in our community work. We have to have respect for the particular gap that is being filled, right, or that people are serving in, and recognize the significance of their contribution, right? Together, we all make a whole community, and we have to recognize the significance of what the effort that other people are making in our community, right? We need to have more care and concern for the Muslims themselves, okay? If we can't show rahmah, compassion for one another as Muslims, how can we rise to this calling to show rahmah and compassion, right, to the non-Muslim society? We must recognize that a variety of roles and callings must work in concert with one another. Theologians at one level, theologians and public intellectuals, at another level, community leaders and elders, and still another level, NGO workers and civil society leaders must all work together and share these different roles and responsibilities if we are going to complete this concert. Academics and other specialists, including academics and other specialists who put their expertise to the service of Islam. In closing, right, we look at the situation of the Prophet Muhammad, right, as he's fleeing from Mecca on his hijra to Medina, right, with his companion Abu Bakr. He is being pursued by Suraqa ibn Malik, right, who was one of the best trackers of the Arabs. You know, he didn't care one way or other. He wasn't offended by the mission of the message of the Prophet Muhammad. He just wanted 100 camels, right, which was the price for the head of Muhammad, alayhi salam. So, with his tracking skills, he sets out and he sees the silhouettes on the horizons and he realizes that must be the two that Quraysh is after. But as he draws near to them, right, he finds that his horse is sinking into the sand, right? And he pulls his horse out and he proceeds further and the same thing happens. And he begins to realize that this man is being protected by a force greater than himself. As he gets closer, he begins to become afraid because the desert is doing things that he's the most khabir, he's the most knowledgeable of the desert, and he's seeing it do things that he's never seen before. He realizes that something strange indeed is afoot, and he realizes that he's going to have to let this man go and forfeit those 100 camels. But he calls out and he asks to draw near. He said, "Allow me, because obviously I can't get close to you unless you permit." Right? These forces of nature are at your disposal, right? This is the steward, right? This is the steward. Yani, when he comes into harmony with the natural world, he begins to wield it like the staff of Moses, right? So the Prophet grants him permission to draw near, and he comes up, right? And he has this conversation with you, and at the moment of his weakness, the Prophet, alayhi salam, fleeing for his life from an overwhelming force, he says to Suraqa, right? He says, "What do you think about a day that will come when you will wear the bracelets of Kisra," right? The leader of Persia. Even in his weakest moment, right? He envisions a time, right? Where things will be in order. Right, he envisions a time. He has not lost hope, right? And he sees that this is there and this is possible, and it did become a reality, right? And despite the situation that and confusion that Muslims or the Muslim community may find themselves now, it's just a reflection of the confusion of the rest of the world, right? But we should be able to envision, if the Muslim community can realize the core of its being It will be able to envision a clear purpose in its world and find the capacity to fulfill this contribution that has been made responsible to make. So I'll conclude with this. I thank you all very much for inviting me, right? And listening, right? Attentively, right? And not throwing any rotten fruit or anything like that. Allah yubarak fikum. Ahsan Allah ilaykum. Thank you.
If there's any questions,
Alaykum salam. Thank you very much.
Like you say, ethic and Sharia. So now when you look at ethic, it's like following the paradigm of liberalism, individualistic existence. I didn't pronounce it.
Mm.
So like, what we think is Islamically correct.
Mm. But I see in there that you're talking about how ethics is something that is engaged in liberal circles, right? Something that's discussed in liberal circles, but still at the same time Muslims are discussing this. How do we balance between the two? I think that, you know, you want to adjust the question? Go ahead. Well, listen. We should never think that ethics is the sole purview, right, of any one group of people, right? Ethics is about looking at what is the situation of the human condition and what is in its best interest. The Islamic venture or enterprise has thoughts on that issue, right, and has thought very deeply over the past, 1400 years or so. About this issue and has something to contribute in that way, to look deeply at what is the nature of the suffering of the human condition and what type of prescriptions can be provided in return. And I think that we have a lot to say. When it comes to liberal courses or liberal readings of Sharia or liberal readings of the Muslim worldview, what it's about is it's not liberal and it's not conservative, right? It's about looking at what is at the heart of that human concern and developing prescriptions and treatments that keep in mind those aims and purposes that we are set here to achieve, right? And looking at how best and possessing a set of methodologies that enable us to develop prescriptions of how best to achieve those aims and purposes, right, while taking into account, right, those human concerns at the heart of this need, right? And this process is something that we can engage in, okay? The important thing is that we realize our aims and purposes, that we have mastery of our methodological tools, okay? And then there will always be new experiences, right, that humanity goes through. Oftentimes, these new experiences can be, we find them echoed in past history, and there are ways that they were treated then, right? But it's just that the circumstances look different, you know? So we shouldn't feel like ethics is the sole purview of liberal schools of thought or something like that. I think that we can come up with things. The liberal directions might, right, is one extreme, and rigidity, okay, is another extreme, and where our struggle is to seek out the center. Right, everyone claims the center, but in reality, that elusive center is the effort that we make, the ijtihad of the mujtahid scholar, to seek out that center constantly, that balance, maintaining or creating or bringing about an equilibrium, right, in the state of affairs of people. Anyone else? What does say it?
Can I just ask you a question? My finding most beautiful understanding of Sharia, that finds so actually beautiful, is your reference to Sharia as a part of water. And in many ways, I suppose one of the problems that the Quran diagnoses in human society is this tendency to always fall back on their own social constructs and their own cultural constructs. And despite the Sharia being a wonderful, universal principle, it seems that it always throws us back into the rhythm of a primordial way of doing things, a natural rhythm.
We spoke about people's own social constructs and cultural things, but then the primordial dual rhythm is going to pervade all of those instances of localized cultures. So where are you going with this?
No. I just want to ask you to elaborate a bit more on this natural rhythm of things. The way that the Sharia, because many people complain about the fact that Sharia is often understood as this body of law.
Right.
And our modern understanding of law is deliberation by human beings on scripture,
right,
on their own human affairs.
Right.
But ultimately, if you look at, if one looks at the notion of an adab or mizan, in the context of Surah Al-Rahman, it's in the middle of a flow of nature.
Right. It's organic. Right.
The sun, the moon. So it seems, what do you think? It seems it's constantly trying to throw you back into a rhythm.
But it comes to life through it's being lived by people and experienced by people, and people are naturally in their context. They are who they are. They have this human soul. This human soul comes through this genesis and the primordial human nature. So we have the universals. Right, we have the cold, dry law, right? But it's made real through human experience. And one of the means that help to bridge the gap between, for example, distant universals or abstract universals and what we experience in our context is not just, it would be first the nature, the original human nature, the fitra, right? But also the recognition that theoretical or abstract law provides us, one of these methodological tools is the recognition of culture itself, right? The recognition of custom, of urf, right? Of context, right? That there is a context that these principles have to be brought to life within. You know?
Following up on that theme, another question. I may seem a bit too conservative when I say this, but I say it for very different reasons than most conservative positions on this. But given the purview of Islamic law and the Quran's constant reference to the rhythms of nature, and given the
What is the reference to the rhythm of nature in the Quran?
Well, the constant reference, first of all, in terms of prayers,
right,
in terms of Ramadan, one should be fast according to the movement of the moon.
Right.
Pray according to the movement of the sun.
Okay. So it's implied in the Quran that it's organically, that the practices of Islam are organically intermixed with the natural world itself.
Yeah, with a certain embeddedness in the natural order, from the seven heavens to the earth. And given given the modern tendency, especially of certain aspects, despite their benefits, given the tendency sometimes to remove us from a more immediate relationship to nature. And to give a very simple example, the question of, for example, the practicality of observing the moon, for example, the practicality of using astronomical calculations is absolutely fine. But do you think that in a modern context, the situation whereby human beings decide increasingly removed away from the immediate observation
mm-hmm.
and connection to nature. I mean,
but this is a displacement, and our modern world is full of displacements, and that's part of the suffering of the modern condition. And that very law, okay, this Sharia law that we're talking about, and hopefully we're understanding it in its broader sense, we're understanding how it is brought to life in organic situations, it's what provides the harmoniousness of the human being as the sole possessor of free will with the ability to be in harmony with his environment, because the environment itself is following laws, okay, but it is in obedience to those laws without freedom of choice, and that's what gives us, right, the beauty, the organic beauty of the natural world and the turning of the seasons and the orbits, you know, the rotation of the earth and the orbit of the planets, right, and the spring and the winter, right, and so on and so forth. It's when the human being first, through his rational faculty, understands those laws, and through the ihsan, through his soul, through his spiritual faculty, right, he understands the import of those and embraces them through a bigger picture, and then becomes drinks in those laws, that he becomes a harmonious part of that organic whole. And yes, these displacements are taking us away from that. And one of the effects of these very displacements, right, that begin with astronomical calculations and go on and on and on from there, right, one of the things that they do is they cause us to misinterpret and misunderstand our own sacred law, right, which is supposed to be playing this organic role in our life. Tayyip, the sister, you had something? Yes.
And ignorance is also injustice.
Mm.
One side and the other. So do you think having forsaken those people, when you say you don't care about them, you criticize them?
Mm. Well.
Because criticism is nothing, and that you want to change them.
Mm.
And I don't know how the Muslim community sees that problem of ignorance and injustice done
Okay. Well, we mentioned before in our three priorities that the point of them being priorities in the days to come is that some of us, in the different roles that we play in the community, need to bring about projects and measures to advance these causes, rectify these problems, strengthen, for example, our ability to employ the methodological tools of the broader understanding of the Sharia in a way that is in balance, in a way that is with ihsan. We need to set into effect ways so that we don't keep developing generations of people that would misapply the law. Okay. One of the other points that I had wanted to make on this trip is that we are beginning to lose touch with the love that we should share for other Muslims, the care that we should share for other Muslims, and we need to bring that back to life, right? I think it was more palpable in the Muslim community in the 80s and the early 90s, but I think that we've begun to lose that. And we need to bring that care for the brother, to, so not just to leave it at criticism, ridicule, right, and so on and so forth. But if we are in a position, we also have to look at what position of responsibility are we in, right? If we're in a position to pull their coat, right, as Malcolm X used to say, right, and bring it to their attention, right, to set up educational programs, those are all good. But what is most important is what you see and what you can do in your own personal sphere of influence. And then we try to increase that number of people who can see what needs to happen, right, through awareness, through conversation, and so on and so forth. But that's where it starts, from one individual to the next, in your relationship with other people, you know. But I say we need to put programs into place, right, into effect. We need to be more proactive, right, and we need to do what we can in our own ways, the own means that are at our disposal. Brother. Alaykum salam wa rahmatullah. Okay, start with one. Make it the best one of the three that you have. Okay.
The first one is I've been in discussions with a certain group, so a certain mission group.
Okay.
But they're always propagating the establishment of Khilafah.
Okay.
Right?
Well, I guess you don't need to mention what group it is.
Yeah. So, and they propose basically really systematic methods of actual methods of So when you gave your compilation thing and basically
Well, there are different senses of Khalifa, okay? Or there are different modes of Khilafa. The head of state, so long as he is applying Islamic law, right, can be called Caliph, just like he can be called Sultan, or he could be called any number of things, and probably will be called any number of things, right? But the head of state can be termed Al-Imam Al-A'zam. In fact, the core principle of it is Al-Imam Al-A'zam, or at the heart of it is Al-Imama, right, which is a particular discussion in the books of Tawheed. But then there are other modes of Khilafah also, of the Caliphate, and that is every human being is Caliph of Allah. Man was placed in إِنِّي جَاعِلٌ فِي الْأَرْضِ خَلِيفَةً. It wasn't, I am going to place a head of state in the earth, but I am going to place an entity, a being, that will be this Caliph, this Khalifa. And in another chapter of the Quran, Allah explains the qualities of that, of the Caliph, of the human being as Caliph, when he tells Dawood, right, to judge between people in fairness. Okay, so these are some of the, it's in this sense that we're talking about returning the conception of the Muslim, of himself or herself, to recognizing and taking up that responsibility that he or she has been imbued with by reason of their own human soul, right? So that's a very different mode than what your unnamed groups may be talking about. They're talking about returning back a Muslim head of secular, head of state, that would then take on the grand authority to ensure that all of these things are going in the society. But each of us, in our own way, in our own sphere of influences, is seeking to ensure that this ihsan, right, pervade in the way of these higher order principles, right, in each aspect of our lives as individuals. So that's at the level that I'm talking at here, speaking about. Okay. Well, it's an obligation of Muslims to establish leadership in the society, right, that will bring about balance and justice, right, in society, right? That's one thing. It's also the responsibility of every individual Muslim, right, to uphold his responsibility to the neighbors, the environment, right, and to his creator and to himself. So there's no contradiction here. Each of them, right, have to apply. So while we wait for that caliph to be reestablished, you know, I hope the group, Yani, has, you know, success in their project. While we wait for that to happen, we shouldn't be waiting in our lives, right, to take up the mantle of responsibility, right, of being insan, right? So there's no conflict. There's no disagreement there. One is about individual responsibility, and one is about secular political responsibility. Both of them we term caliph, but in different modes of being. Other people have questions?
Yeah,
so. Yes. Yes. Yes.
And whereas, like, you also mentioned the Sheikh of Kalabuti,
who was one of the foremost opponents. Right.
Can you give us sort of...
And I was just in a meeting with the two of them where they got along famously. Right?
So, can you basically explain what Kalabuti is?
That will be the next lecture. Right. Next time we visit Cambridge, we'll give a lecture on fiqh al-qaliyat, because it will require quite a bit of explanation. But when it comes down to it, Dr. Bhuti's concern is that there will be multiple fiqhs, multiple universes or solar systems of fiqh, its rules and its applications for different regions of the world. And the Muslims will be following essentially multiple deens and understandings, whereas Sheikh Abdullah bin Baya is saying, and those who are proponents of the idea are saying, that there are special circumstances in minority situations which may require a fatwa that would be given differently to those that would be given in the Muslim world. However, if we step back and we look at the middle, right, we'll look straight down the middle, and we see that it's contextual, right? What we're talking about is dictates of context. So when you have a context that has certain requirements or is requiring something of the population or the people living into it, well, then the opinion or the ruling is going to be such and such. If that same context and its requirements hold somewhere in the Muslim world, then the ruling will be the same as it was there, right? But one of the most important conditions of the mufti that more often than not we lose through the cracks in our day and age is the obligation of, or the condition of, the soundness of iftah, that the mufti understand intimately the context of the mustafti, the person asking the question, right? Or the community putting up the question, right? That is lost when in translation, literally and figuratively. And we need to ameliorate that, and that goes into the priorities, right, that we've been talking about for the days ahead for the community. Anybody else? Go ahead, sir.
Just want to think about the issue.
Okay.
The issue of amana, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says, inna a'adna al-amana al-salam, we offer amana on the heavens and the mountains, they reduced it.
Right.
And what happened that means that, and the human being took it.
Right.
And then it was discovered that Talun and Jabu, what does, is that something built into the human being, or is it?
So much as the ego is built into the human being. And the idea of the human being zalum and jahula, right, oppressive. A zalim is someone who oversteps bounds. Jahul is an ignorant. And ignorant, if he doesn't uphold this amana, right, as the terms of this individual mode of khilafah dictates, he becomes this zalum and jahul, right? If he forfeits the amana, he becomes the zalum and jahul, and those are only qualities, right? Tendencies of the human ego, if it is not refined through this process of ihsan that we talked about, that only makes the stewardship possible. Those are the insights that come in response to your question. Fadl Sayyid.
I think the question, you referred to the two conditions of consciousness and...
Conscientiousness.
Any translation to that?
Well, consciousness, I see it as illustrated in من له قلب وألقى سمع وهو الشهيد. I see it illustrated in the quality of having a dhamir, right? But that would also go back to conscientiousness, right? ما له dhamir, right? He doesn't think about others, right? And the conscientiousness, so I see those as English terms that sum up a number of principles found in our Arabic language sources, right? Consciousness would be yaqidh, right? Yaqadha. An-nasu niyam, wa idha matu intabahu, right? That would be consciousness, right? Conscientiousness would be ihsan, right? There's summations. You can sum up with that term many different concepts that are working within our tradition. Tayyib? Sayyid? Khalas?
Not sure.
Right? Right? Yeah, well, I think you used up all your cards. Inshallah, we'll talk to you afterwards, inshallah. What's that, sir? Okay, inshallah. What does being stern toward the disbelievers? We just gave a Friday sermon in Abu Dhabi about compassion and how Muslims can be compassionate to the non-Muslims. And this question was asked afterwards, and that's a very good question. And at the moment, right, oof, we had a very good answer. Let's see if I can pull something right out. So we have this idea of compassion, and we are clear beyond a shadow of a doubt that the compassion of the Muslim applies not just to Muslims alone, but to everyone that we share this earth with. Now, at the same time, we find the verse in the Quran that describes the believers that they are compassionate with one another and stern with the unbelievers. But that sternness or firmness with the unbelievers, okay, does that preclude compassion? Right? Not necessarily, right? There is a moment that where it is the epitome of compassion for another to tell them no. To tell them that the red line is here and it's not going to be crossed. Right? Just like with a child, it is not compassionate with the child to let them do whatever it is they want to do until their intellect is complete and they can make proper judgments for themselves. And so that sternness only comes from a compassion. But in this instance with the non-Muslim who is aggressing against the Muslims, not every non-Muslim, an aggressive non-Muslim, right? That sternness, that blocking their force with sufficient force, right? It only emanates from compassion. And that's why in a martial jihad consists of the application of sufficient force and watching or observing, the monitoring the sufficiency of force is only emanating from the heart of compassion, right? So there are so that I think gives an answer to that question. Right, but with the Muslims, right, more so you're seeing this face of compassion in all instances, but there are times when you have to put your foot down too, right? Tayyip, we'll close with that.
Thank you once again.